Good evening, lovelies. Welcome to another episode of Coffee, Candy, and Creatives. My creative tonight is director Rachel Poynton. Her documentary, Civil War, or Who Do We Think We Are, is available to watch now on Peacock with a special showing on MSNBC Sunday night, October 24th at 10 p.m. This is an in-depth, eye-opening look into how American history is perceived by different people. This episode is brought to you by the House on Foggy Bluff Ghost Walk. It is going on October 22nd to 31st from 8 p.m. till midnight. Tickets are $15 per person, $12 for those 12 and under. Head over to www.greengables.org for more information. Grab a cup of coffee or your favorite beverage, cuddle up with your host Puff, and enjoy the show.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing fantastic. I was just reading up on the documentary, and it took you, well, not took you, but it's a four-year span, right? At least.
I started thinking about the film in 2015.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I got the idea for the film in July of 2015. I got access to my first school in December of 2015. And I started shooting in January of 2016, so the last year of Obama's presidency. And I filmed a significant portion of the film in 2016, actually. And then the film kind of built on itself as we went along.
That's amazing. So what happened in 2015 that like was a catalyst, or is this something you'd always thought about and you were just like, hey?
No, not at all. I listened to, well, I used to listen to a radio show called The Diane Rehm Show, which is, it was based out of Washington, D.C. on NPR. And she's a fabulous journalist. And she used to have a two-hour radio show every day. She now has a weekly podcast, but I was a big fan of the radio show. And she did this radio show after the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina in 2015. Where that young man went into the Black church and killed a bunch of people.
Right.
And then posted pictures of himself online with the Confederate flag and sort of did this online tour to various Civil War sites. But he very much connected what he had done quite purposefully to Civil War memory. So Diane Rehm did a show about how the Civil War was being taught in classrooms. And I listened to that show, and it was the first time that I came across the fact that there were many people in this country who did not believe that the Civil War was fought over slavery and who didn't want to teach their children that the Civil War was fought over slavery. And it occurred to me that that fact, just that basic fact, was a window into understanding the roots of why we're still so divided. And I thought to myself, I wonder how that history is being taught and remembered today around the country. How are we telling our common story? Mm-hmm. And so it started with that thought, that question. And then I went from there.
For a lot of people, and American class was a long time ago for me.
Me too.
a lot of the things that we're over the past, you know, few years, it's like, I was never taught that. And I wondered, as you did, I wondered if perhaps, because I was raised in Florida, technically the South, I guess, but Florida's kind of its own thing anyways. But I wondered if it was taught differently in the North, in the South, you know, out West. And I really, it's not something, I don't think it's something that you pay attention to unless it's directly affecting you. And I think that's just humanity in general. We're kind of very self-centered in a way. And it wasn't until just like a few months ago, I was able to talk to Miss Opal Lee. My eyes were open, and I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but my eyes were open. And, you know, I asked my kids, I was like, hey, did you learn about, no, you know, and it's, so I think we're still, our kids are still not being taught true history.
I think it depends on where you are. Mm-hmm. And one thing I came to realize over the course of making this film is that it's not just about, you know, being taught the wrong story. It's also about what we just, the silences, the big empty spaces in our education. Like, you know, when I realized when I started making this film, in in my education, and I went to what are considered to be very good schools, I was never required to read Frederick Douglass. It was just not ever required reading. That is criminal. he is one of the founding voices of our nation. His voice is incredible, and there's so much to be learned. You know, from W.E.B. Du Bois, I was never required to read his work. That's a crime. It's a huge part of our country's story. And when I was in college, you know, there would be these African-American history classes. And I always thought to myself, oh, I don't need to take that. That's not my history. That's not my story, right? That's for African-American students who want to learn about African-American history. That's absurd. It's American history. It's very much my story and your story and the story of all Americans. And it needs to be understood as our story. It is our story. So a big part of my revelation in the making of this film wasn't just about the causes of the war, how that was being taught. It was about all the people and things that had just been completely ignored in terms of what was covered in the classroom.
Right. I mean, absolutely. I feel like, well, see, here's the thing. We're not required, not like you said, we're not required to learn certain things. We're not required to take specific classes. Well, then why the heck was it a requirement for me to take British literature senior year? You know, nothing against it.
It's interesting. I do think the standards are based on a sort of antiquated notion. What we studied the point of view of the people who were in power. We studied from the point of view of the power holders. So essentially a white, straight, male, Christian, landholding point of view, which was often English because that's, you know, British. And that was what we learned. The thing is that America today is a very different place. It's a very diverse place. And we as a nation need to understand our story, not just from the point of view of the white men who were in power, but from the point of view of the women who participated, of the Black people who participated, the Chinese immigrants who came. But like the story of this, it's a very complicated, nuanced, layered story of what America is. And it's much richer than what we were taught.
Right, because as you said, the books that were printed, you know, that were written and printed came from the mouth of, like you said, the white, straight, male, landholding, wealthy, religious people. So that's the story that they told. You know, you didn't have input from any other culture or anybody else that was, you know, just for the Native Americans or the real Americans, their story has been so twisted. It's and it's to fit a narrative, and you're right. And it's antiquated.
There's a book that I read while I was making this film called Lies My Teacher Told Me. It's a good intro to the things that we're talking about before you might want to dive into deeper subjects, but it's by a guy, James Lowen. He died recently. I actually filmed with him for the movie. It didn't make the cut, but I'm a big fan of James Lowen, and I want to pump his book here called Lies My Teacher Told Me. It's a wonderful sort of introduction to an understanding of all the things that maybe you just didn't cover in your history class.
All right. Absolutely. I mean, if you have to think back, and I'm not I'm kind of ashamed that, but it's not my fault. As a child, I was, you know, I didn't have control over what books they handed me. But if I think they mentioned George Washington Carver, you know, and you didn't hear about anything else. To learn in American history class that the Civil War was the South had slaves, the North didn't like it, and they fought about it, and the North won. And then everybody lived happily ever after, because that's basically what the history books told you. And it's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, there's a moment in the film where one of the things I do in the movie is I let the students I interview ask me questions. And there's a moment in the film where a young Black woman in Mississippi asks me, what do you think of this whole slavery thing? Like, I mean, she doesn't say it out loud, but she's basically saying, you white person, like, what do you think? you know, I said to her, like, I was just never taught about slavery as a white story. I was never taught about the reality of slavery as a business, as an industry, as a way that the economy functioned, as something that benefited white people, that created a way of seeing individuals that then was perpetuated over time, you know, where the policy of slavery created white, like engendered white supremacy. It wasn't that we enslaved Black people because we thought we were superior. It was we enslaved Black people and then we told ourselves we were superior. It helped us feel better about what we were doing. So it you know, the feeling of being better than that is still very much entrenched in this society. That comes, it's a long, long line, but it comes from a history that we share. And I say this, by the way, you know, on my mother's side of the family, they're Jewish Polish people who came here long after slavery was over. So even though on my father's side of the family, they were here for forever, I do believe that any person who appears as white and walks through the world in America is a part of the story, right? I mean, we're all part of the story because we're American citizens. So, and we all have to own it as our American history, our American story.
I'm the same, like, father came, his family came here from Spain in like 1960. And on my mother's side, they're Canadian. So I was like, we weren't even here, but that doesn't excuse me. But I still, for, you know, not as a representative, but as, you know, someone who resembles the people that have done this in the past, we still have a responsibility to make sure that the actual history is out there.
It also affects the way that we get to walk through the world in America. So the reason why it's our story is because it's literally our story. Like, it you know, when you walk into the grocery store, how someone looks at you versus how someone might look at a person of color. It's a different, people walk through the world with different perspectives and different experiences. So I just think that the question of race and the history of race and the history of racism, some people call the caste system of America, it's something that we need to own as part of the American story and part of who we are today.
Right. I mean, it's very much whitewashed. I don't know if that term's overused, but it is. It's whitewashed. And there's so many to sweep it under the rug. And there's a real lack of accountability, I feel. And I don't know of some people that refuse to believe, A, that it ever actually happened. Because there's some people out there that are like, oh, slavery never happened. It's like, are you a moron? Because
I didn't come across that. I didn't come across people saying slavery never happened. I did come across a lot of people who said it wasn't so bad, which shocked me. Like the notion that slavery wasn't so very bad, that it was like, I mean, the justifications that people have are kind of mind blowing that they, but I think that, I mean, one, just to talk about the film specifically, like, I think one of the things that's special about this movie, one of the things I like about the movie is that it takes you into all these different spaces all over the country. And it sort of gives you a window into how other people think and feel. And it's not judging people. I wasn't going around making fun of people or telling jokes about them or showing how stupid they are. I was going around really trying to listen to how people feel and to try and understand why people feel the way they do. Because from my point of view, that's a prerequisite for having any kind of real reunion, is actually listening to each other and treating each other as human beings and assuming that we have feelings for reasons, that we are not, you know, half of the country is not stupid. It's not just because we are politically divided, just because we don't necessarily agree on facts even, doesn't mean that the other people who don't think like us are somehow less human than we are. And right. I think that aspect of the film can make people really uncomfortable because it's not something that we're used to doing today, especially in the news or issues get painted as very black and white. And by the way, I do think we have to insist on facts, on truth, we can't be wishy-washy with alternative facts. But given where we are as a people, as an American society, I do think it's important to treat each other as human beings with compassion and with an open heart and trying to understand the place that that we're each coming from, to from the get-go assume that we are all human and to treat each other as such. I think it's a special thing in the film.
Right. And there, you're right. There is such a problem with people. People can't accept that other people have different opinions. It's not a case of, well, this is my opinion.
This is a tough one, though. This is a tough subject because there really are facts. And like, there really are facts that have been denied, and it's not okay. And, you know, we can't, I don't think that should be tolerated. We can't sit around and debate the facts or allow for alternative facts. And the truth is the Lost Cause was a myth that wasn't real, and we need to acknowledge that. But we also have to recognize that when we say that, what we're asking people to do is to essentially divorce themselves from, you know, years of family history. Right. And that's a very big ask emotionally. Mm-hmm. And that needs to be acknowledged, right? That there has to be some sense that, you know, we are acknowledging the truth in order to heal.
Right. And to be able to lay out the facts and still have a polite demeanor about it without, you know, banging you over the head. And like you said, understanding, okay, that's what you believe, or that's how you're living your life. And then can you take me into that? Can you help me understand why?
And also to acknowledge our own blind spots. I mean, I think one thing that people in the North do a lot is they point fingers at the South. And it's really easy to talk about Southern racism. It's really easy to talk about Southern wrongdoing. Northerners are totally in the dark about racism in their own cities and cultures. They don't acknowledge it at all. And so I am a big believer in look at yourself in the mirror before you cast the stone. Take a look at how you're living your life before you start pointing the finger. And I think that's something that needs to be done, particularly in the North.
Have you found over the course of talking to people that there's a good proportion or a good percentage that want to be like, oh, well, that was so long ago. Can't we just move on?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, look, it's talking about the past is, especially the painful past, it's like, why do I want to spend time doing that? Why do I want to do that? And the answer is we want to do it so we can actually have a better future. We want to air this. We want to finally, it's like family therapy or something with some big family secret that hasn't been dealt with and that no one really wants to talk about. And we all just want to pretend like it didn't happen. And until we get in a room and we acknowledge that it happened and that it's real, it's not going to be possible to really have healing. And we are like a country that never had a Truth and Reconciliation Committee. We never had an acknowledgement. And so we have lived as a society with this suppression, North and South. This is not just a Southern problem. I mean, you can point the finger at the South in terms of, I don't believe slavery was the cause of the war. But in terms of the narrative, in terms of what's being ignored, it's been everywhere. It's not just in one place.
Racism across the board against any basically non-European, heritage is still to this day. So, you know, it's such a big problem. It's not, 150 years ago. Okay. That was, you know, a long time ago, but it's not over. We're still doing it.
Well, one of the interesting things I think in the film too, is we interviewed all these students all over the country. And one of the things I did was I asked the students, I would ask the students, if you were going to tell your own story, how would you want to tell it? Or if you would want people to see something about you, what would you want them to see? Right. And it was my way of kind of giving them some control back over how I was portraying them. But I think that question of how people want their own stories to be told or how they want to be seen is worth asking, because there's been a lot of telling of the story by the people in power rather than allowing people to tell their own stories. So,
right. To really super simplify it, it's like when you hear a rumor about yourself and you're like, I did.
What? That's not right. No. Yeah, totally.
How it happened. But yeah, so the kids that you interviewed, from what age range was it?
I think the film actually captures the age range that we felt, like, has both the youngest and the oldest. The youngest were 8 years old and the oldest were in college. And we filmed in Massachusetts and Tennessee and Mississippi and Washington, D.C. and a little in Pennsylvania and a little in Connecticut and a little in Louisiana. And so it's not a full-on 50-state thing, but it is a pretty wide swath of the country and of the places in the country, of certain places in the country that were deeply marked by these events.
Right. So a distinct North and South representation. Yeah.
That was the goal.
So from 8 to college, I mean, there's the basic little history and social studies at the elementary, get a little more advanced in middle school, high school, and then college. And you're seeing across the board that there's missing pieces. Personally, yeah. All I learned, everything I know about slavery, I learned from Alex Haley's books, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, they didn't teach us. They didn't teach us that in school. They didn't teach us the horrificness. I didn't even know till I was a grown up that it took a year and a half after the Emancipation Proclamation for in Texas for them to truly be free. I'm like, I didn't learn this.
Well, it wasn't only in Texas, although we do celebrate Juneteenth because of Texas, but it wasn't only in Texas. I think one of the things that really struck me while I was making this film was after the Civil War ended, 4 million people in this country were emancipated. They were no longer enslaved. That's amazing. 4 million people were free. Now talk about a holiday. If you want to celebrate something, let's celebrate the liberation of 4 million people in this country. Now let's think for a second. Growing up, did we ever celebrate that? Did we ever acknowledge that at the end of the Civil War, 4 million people were newly free? No, because that's not what we celebrated. What we did was we remembered the white dead people and all the people who had died with Memorial Day. By the way, that holiday did not start that way. It didn't start as a holiday to remember the white dead, but that's what it became. It really struck me as we were making this film that in the South, you know, there's a day to remember Robert E. Lee's birthday. It happens in many places to fall on the same day as Martin Luther King's day, which is sort of shocking, but very purposeful, I think, in its own way. The fact that we as a nation have not chosen to celebrate that, that's a national wrong. That's not a Northern wrong or a Southern wrong. That's a national wrong. And so that's what I'm talking about in terms of memory. Like, I think we, especially, I live in the North, so especially Northern folks, white folks, we need to stop pointing the finger and really come to terms with our own role in how these stories are perpetuated or not told in our culture.
Absolutely. I mean, there really needs to be a push for accurate history. And my thought was there should be a push for American history, accurate American history in school. And I feel like maybe a state-specific history as well, because there's a lot of stop that. There's a lot of stuff that went down in your own, like, personal state.
Oh, for sure.
Like you said, Mississippi. I mean, my God, the lynchings, the civil rights movement, things like that, that I don't think are covered well enough in school.
There's a piece of the movie that deals with, that's shot in Mississippi in a place called Clinton, Mississippi. That's the film is told in episodes. So it unfolds, it's like these little bubbles. We talked about them as bubbles when we were in the cutting room. And It goes around the country and it takes you to one place, and then you'll have like a little episode in that place, and then you'll go to another place and there'll be an episode in that place. And one of the episodes in the portion of the film that deals with Reconstruction unfolds in Clinton, Mississippi, and it has to do with a historian named Melissa Jones, who has been for like the past, I think, 15 years or something, trying to get a marker up in Clinton to acknowledge the fact that there was a massacre that took place there where a bunch of white Democrats slaughtered these Black Republicans who had tried to have a political rally. They were trying to prevent them from voting. And for over 100 years, that story was completely deliberately mistold. And it was told as if the Black Republicans had been the ones who had risen up and acted violently against the white people. Totally untrue, completely false. And Missy has tried very hard to get this marker put up. Today, while we were filming, that marker had finally been put up. Today, that marker has been knocked down yet again. It keeps getting knocked down. Somehow that marker just won't stay standing. And for me, it's a very poignant symbol of how hard it is to really remember these aspects of the past and the forces that really just don't want to think about this and really think it's better if we just ignore it. It's a problem.
It's a huge problem. And this might be polarizing to say personally, but I don't understand the stupid, stubborn, rebel Southern pride. I don't understand it.
Well, I can understand it to some degree. I mean, I think here's the thing, you know, David Blight, who's a wonderful historian, says this in the movie, and I think it's worth saying out loud, that for a lot of people, a lot of white people in particular, the Confederate flag they have not seen it as a symbol of white supremacy. They've seen it as a symbol of Southern pride and as a symbol of like the capacity of the South to rise up and have, you know, like the rebel heart, the capacity to fight back, independent spirit, right? For them, that's what that flag symbolizes. The reality is that historically, they're just wrong. That isn't what the flag symbolizes. They can think that that's what the flag, that is not the story of that flag. Right. And so to pretend that that's the story of that flag is to discount and ignore the reality of the history of what it really represents, which is white supremacy and right. An assertion of white supremacy by the South. So it's not, I can understand, I don't think people necessarily wear the flag or embrace the flag because they see themselves as white supremacists, but they certainly aren't acknowledging the fullness of the story of what that flag represents.
Right. And I feel like perhaps a lot of them are white supremacists.
That's probably true too. I mean, it's open white supremacy. And I think the past, you know, 4 years of our four and a half, you know, like the Trump years certainly brought to light a lot of deep-rooted feelings that I think people for many years had just felt like they couldn't say out loud. It's a huge problem, open white supremacy in this country.
I mean, it's just been, it's something to me that's like, it's always been there. I mean, it's evident, but you're right. In the last few years or so, it seems like it's amped up so much. And yeah, when a person in power, not to get all political, but when a person in power not only allows, but embodies it or acts that way themselves. Yeah, it's like the kids want to misbehave. Well, the parents are misbehaving. Well, I'm going to misbehave too. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I feel like it's good that they are outing themselves more publicly because now we can be like, okay, I see you. And it can be addressed, but it's so sad to me that people still believe that they are any better than anybody else because of the color of their skin. Who told you that? Who put that fault in your head?
But I think part of the point of the movie for me is that while blatant white supremacists are a real problem in this country, the part that's harder maybe to recognize is the subtle white supremacy of everything else. and that it's not just a problem of these hardcore violent racists. Right. That frankly, I can't believe represent the majority of this country. I just don't buy it. I don't buy that they're the majority. I know they're a problem. I know they're real. But I think there's a much bigger problem that needs to be addressed too.
Absolutely. And I feel like you're on the right track with it. It's education and understanding, honestly.
Yeah. And self-reflection, you know, without anger or judgment, without vitriol, without putting each other down or pretending like one person's superior to somebody else. You know, a little bit of humility would do this country a lot of good.
Right. Absolutely. And accountability.
Humility, yeah, and both. Absolutely.
And it's so funny, like the subtle racism. And there's also like a, I can't think of the right word for it, but it's when you see something, but you just kind of like, you don't say anything or you don't do anything because you don't want to get involved. I don't know if complacency is the word I want, but you know, if someone shows you like a racist video or, you know, something that's making fun of another culture, or it's, you know, and you don't call them out and be like, that's, you know, that's not cool. That's not, you know, that's not appropriate or whatever. And you just kind of go, you know, fake smile and like move on with your day because you don't want to get involved with it. You know, I don't know if we can be better at that too.
That's a good question. I mean, I think the reality is that the questions of how we tell our past and how we deal with race and racism in our culture, this is super uncomfortable for everybody. I mean, white and black, north and south, I think we're all really uncomfortable. But I do think it's important that people with good intentions learn to speak up in mm-hmm. those situations. And right. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to be demeaning. You can just, but I do think speaking up, speaking truth is important, both for yourself, like for how you feel walking away from that situation, but also to let the other person know that, you know, just because you're white doesn't mean that you agree with this.
Right. Right. Exactly. And it's like, who do you think you're talking to? Because you're just going to come at me because we have the same skin color, that I'm going to necessarily have the same, you know, beliefs or proclivities that you have. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, so how are things in Florida in terms of the racial conversation today?
Oh, it depends on where you are. There's a lot of, I call them good old boys, but it's good old boys and girls.
Yeah.
In areas in Florida, because there's a lot of country areas, but the cities are a little more forward thinking, and there's more unity. For instance, I used to work in a city, and it was, I want to say it was after George Floyd was killed, but there was a very peaceful march from one area to another area that was black, white, brown, everyone. But there's other areas around where I am that you see certain former guys' flags flying everywhere. You hear the N-word, you know, screamed out windows at people. So it really depends on where you're at, I think.
Why do you think that, like, from your point of view as someone who's grown up in Florida, why do you think that is? Why do you think they hold on to that? I'm just curious.
I honestly don't know. I feel like, I think it's a lack of education. I think a lot of maybe income or have to do with it, where maybe they didn't finish high school. They definitely didn't go to college. A lot of these people, I think they work physical jobs, manual labor. I just don't think they know any better. And if they do know any better, they just don't care. They honestly, I have seen people who think they're so much better than other people. And then I find myself being judgmental because I'm like, who are you to think that you're so much better than somebody else? And then I think there's that stubbornness. I think that they fight for the sake of fighting, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like they could be told 1,000 times that the sky is blue. They can see that the sky is blue, but if they believe it's purple, so help them God, because it's just, they can't be changed. And I think it's how they're raised. I think it's a lack of education. I think it's the fact that they act so outrageous and so aggressive that nobody wants to call him out on it.
Do you think part of it has to do with economic insecurity? Like, you know, I think a lot of people in this country feel left behind by the direction of economic development in America. And I think that can make people feel like they want to feel better. Like you want to feel your power where you can, right? Mm-hmm. Do you think that has anything to do with it?
I would say yes, because I think if there's insecurities in other aspects of life and they find one thing that they can kind of hold on to and lord over other people. Yeah, absolutely. I got into a screaming match with a friend over the January 6th thing. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to go on and on about how good that person in power had been for the country and for them personally. And I said, okay, you're missing the entire fact of what happened. I mean, it was bad, but it's like that kind of thinking, that kind of, oh, well, this serves me. This made me money. This, you know, benefits me to the exclusion of all the BS, you know? So I'm going to just ignore everything that's wrong because all of this was right for me. So it's selfishness, self-serving, ignorance, lack of education, however you want to look at it. I think that's what it is. And I think it's probably boiled down to stubbornness, a refusal
I also think it's pain. I think there's pain in it. There has to be pain in the person who needs to walk around and tell themselves that they're superior. Why else would you do that? There has to be pain in that. And I think, I don't know, I believe that we need to start understanding the pain of ordinary people and trying to support citizens. And you know, as a country, I mean, this is going way beyond the Civil War, but, you know, like from healthcare to education to childcare, how does anyone survive? Everything is so expensive. Mm-hmm. I have two kids. I don't know how anyone survives. And, you know, I think as a society, we don't do a very good job of letting citizens know that the country cares, cares about what happens to them.
To go just a tad deeper real quick, and then we can get back. Do you personally believe that some people are just inherently bad?
No, I don't. I have this conversation with my 10-year-old. Well, she's 11 now, but she just turned 11. But I just had this conversation the other day that no, I don't believe that anyone's inherently bad. I think people do bad things. And I think we are all filled with infinite possibilities. And I think the human heart is capable of many things. I believe in potential of every human. I just think that, you know, there needs to be the things that you're talking about in terms of people insisting on falsehood, in terms of violence or diminishing of other people in order to feel better about themselves. I mean, this is why we have laws. This is why we, you know, there need to be rules of engagement for how we treat each other, right? But at the same time, we have a problem in this country where there is a real, like the story, it does in some way go back to the story that we're telling about who we are. It is not including all of us. And the question of how we're going to tell a story, not just storytelling, but also actual acts, like what are we doing to, you know, people who lose their jobs at a local plant when it shuts down? What is being done to help them rebuild their lives? How are, you know, are we just leaving them there to find their way? You know, the question of, there's a subtitle in this film, who do we think we are, right? The fundamental question about this film is, how are we going to be a better we? And it's doing it through the stories we tell. That's the lens of this movie. But the deep question of this film is really a deep question about how we can come together as a nation, the paths that we need to take in order to care for our citizens in a larger way and to include all of them in the stories we tell.
Right. And it's so strange. and of course, misinformation from the media, misinformation from our textbooks that our children are learning from. And also, I feel like sometimes we almost have it together, almost we get really on the right track, you know, working side by side, things unite us for short periods of time. And then I'm trying really hard not to curse, I apologize. And then some, and then it's boom, it's blown up again and we're far apart again. And I feel like we just need a second without anything freaking happening.
Well, it's a question of leadership too. I mean, there are all sorts of issues here. I mean, social media, I think, is not helpful. You know, the divisions that happen just on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, people falling into their own silos of information and truth. It's become a lot harder for us to see each other as human and to listen to each other.
Right. And it doesn't help that we have a pandemic as well. So it's another thing to divide us. And then it's not just dividing.
Think about that. I'm sorry. Think about that for a second. Why didn't the pandemic unite us? Like, why of all the things, like the moments when we have felt united as a country, it's been world wars. It's been the Great Depression. Why would the pandemic, this thing that touches you, no matter the color of your skin, no matter how much money you have, no matter where you live, it affects you and your neighbor the same. I mean, you know, some people might get sicker than others, but I'm just saying it's not just discriminating against people right. for some superficial reason. Why would that not unite us? The answer is politics and politicians. From the get-go, it was used as a tool to further divide. It did not have to be that way. Didn't have to be that way.
Absolutely. Agree 1,000%. I was like, when it first started coming out, like, oh crap, this is serious. I said, oh my God, imagine if something this, you know, this horrible, this devastating was the thing that brought us together. But no, here we are, we're still. And then it even got its little subdivisions, if that's the word, between people in their own races. And I'm like, how is this? Oh my God. Like, you're right about social media. I just went on Facebook for the first time in probably, I don't know, 6 months. And boom, one of my first notifications was of a school friend that had passed away from COVID. I'm like, oh God, that's horrible. In the comments section, don't you know they were fighting about the vaccine? And I'm like, are you, again, bad word, are you idiot serious? Because this man died. And you want to use his comment section on his little social media page to further your agendas on yes or no on the vaccine. It's ridiculous. People just need to.
I think I believe that a lot of that stuff is like Russian bots. I swear to God, I really think that, you know, there's like a lot of foreign interference and just like sowing of division. I would love to see a documentary about that, you know.
Absolutely. There you go. There's your next project.
I don't want to do that film, but somebody should make that film.
I just want to watch it. You're right. Oh, it's so like, it feels like there's outside interference. Like you said, I mean, we know we got to get our crap together. We know we're a problem. We know we have problems, but I do feel like sometimes there's something else, something bigger than us or someone bigger than us. If it's an organization, we're getting into conspiracy, but if it's an organization, and my ex-husband, he asked me, he's like, well, why would somebody do that? I said, why would somebody want this country just completely divided about everything? Are you kidding me? How about your kids are fighting? And that means that you can stand in plain sight eating a candy bar and they're not going to know because they're too busy fighting with each other.
That's right.
They want Americans distracted for what purpose? I don't know.
We need to try and find points of connection, and we need to try and treat each other with empathy and understanding. And we need to look in the mirror and be open with ourselves about the places that we as individuals can improve rather than constantly pointing the finger at everybody else. And to see our fellow citizens as fellow citizens, right? We are in this together.
Literally. I find also it's not necessarily an extreme. It's kind of like this gradient, but it's like people that forget about it. I'm going to say what I'm going to say, you know, I'm superior, you know, I'm supreme, blah, blah, blah. And then you've got over here, you've got the people that are afraid to, they're so cautious and so afraid that they're going to insult someone, you know, oh, I shouldn't say this because it might insult a person of this race or this culture. It's like, okay, now you're giving yourself anxiety. You need to find yourself a little kind of, can we come together in the center where we respect each other, but we're also not afraid to ask the question or, you know, afraid that we're going to offend.
Yeah, I worry about that. I mean, I think the dialogue in our country right now is very damaged. We have to stop worrying about saying the wrong thing, and we need to act with good intentions and openness and you know, there having a true dialogue in this country right now is very hard. I also, by the way, I think that's one thing that makes the film special, because the tone of this film is very different from the majority of what's out there, in terms of its willingness to listen and its willingness to ask questions that are uncomfortable and to not condemn people for their answers, but to still insist on truth. All of that, it's kind of modeling what I hope we can do as a nation.
And you can tell watching the film, the kids that you talk to, it doesn't seem like they were really nervous or scared. They were engaged. They were like passionate about what they were talking about. And you can tell that they were comfortable. So I'm glad to hear that you, like, you know, you said that, you know, it's okay. You can say what you, we're not going to be like, oh my God, you're fine. Say what you want to say, say what you feel, ask your questions. This is a safety, you know, this is a safe zone for you. Sorry, I'm going back a little bit. I wanted to ask you, there's a mix of cultures and races in the kids that you talk to. How were you accepted as a white person asking questions? Were they?
I mean, I think, you know, when I walk through first of all, in my other films, I'm not in my other films. You hear my voice asking questions, but there's like no shot of me in the film. And in this film, there are like two shots of me in the beginning to sort of acknowledge this is what the filmmaker looks like, right? Mm-hmm. And those were not there. I mean, those were very late additions to the movie. Because a lot of people were questioning my authority, like, what gives you the right to make this movie? I got asked that many, many times as I was making this film. Who do you think you are to make this film? Mm-hmm. So it's just sort of acknowledging who I am. But I think I am who I am, and people are going to respond to me the way they respond to me. And I don't feel a need to be something other than what I am. My attitude, and I've filmed in many places all over the world in lots of different circumstances with presidents and people living in slums and everything in between. I mean, my attitude is that if you're willing to listen without judgment and to give people the opportunity to tell their own story or to speak for themselves, I think that's usually really appreciated. And of course, the material I'm getting is determined in part by the fact that I'm white, the fact that I'm a woman, the fact that I'm a Northerner, but that's just who I am. Mm-hmm. And if a white Northern man went into the situation, that would be determining what he got. If a Black woman went, it's always determined by who we are. And I just don't think that's a problem.
That's good. I can imagine going in and maybe, you know, people of color being hesitant to really open up without you that they could open up, because it's like, you know.
Well, I think, like, okay, let's talk about the Clinton piece again. There's a scene in that Clinton section where I go into the home of a Black woman, and her family is there, and they very kindly talk to me and my white cameraman. And I think if a Black camera person and a Black director had shot that scene, it would probably feel very different, right? A Black person would probably have asked very different questions. The dynamic in that room would have felt really different. In the white, you know, the East Bridgewater Civil War roundtable that I filmed at, that was all white. If a Black crew had filmed that, it probably would have felt really different, you know? I think we walk through this, as filmmakers, we walk through the spaces we walk through, and who we are is part of our process. It's part of our filmmaking. It's just not a problem for me. I think you need to acknowledge it, and you need to be open and humble, and acknowledge that you have a particular point of view, but I think it's okay.
Right. And I guess maybe accept that you might not get the reaction or the answers that you were hoping for, and it's because
I don't hope for answers. When I go into a space, I'm not hoping for anything. I am going into a space, and I am truly, my goal is to be open. It is not to walk into a space with an expectation of what someone's going to say to me. And sometimes, you know, in a space, especially when you're dealing with race, you have to say like, hey, I know I'm white and I know it's really uncomfortable, but, you know, like, and you can talk about it. You can acknowledge it as an issue in the room. And sometimes that can make people more comfortable, but I'm never trying to pretend like I'm not white or like it's not an issue, or it's just part of the way I'm walking through the world and the way I'm filming.
That's great though. I mean, I feel just from like watching, like I said, it looked like they were able to speak freely, and that must be so like, oh, to be able to answer, because I feel like kids in school, they kind of figure sometimes that maybe that's not the answer that the teacher wanted.
Right.
Viral videos of like a kid arguing with a teacher, and then you read the comment section and forget about it because there's opposite sides for sure.
Right. Well, I think it's another example of like when I'm filming with anybody, my goal is to be open and to listen, to really do my best to listen, and to listen with humility and a sense that I don't know everything. And simultaneously, I have a very strong point of view. I'm not somebody with no point of view. So I think it's all good.
And I feel like if you're open, it's going to be responded to that way. It's going to open up too. I know it's on Peacock, right? So anybody can stream it on Peacock or...
Yeah. It's going to be airing on MSNBC on October 24th at 10 p.m. It's a Sunday night. So on October 24th at 10 p.m., it will air on MSNBC. That will probably be the easiest way for a lot of people to see it. It is in theaters in Los Angeles and New York. It is available to be streamed on Peacock. That's very easy. It's free. Yeah,
that's fantastic. So MSNBC, that's huge. Is there a website that people can go and...
People can go to the Facebook page. That's the easiest way to get event information and screening and updated screening information. So you can just look for Civil War or Who Do We Think We Are on Facebook and you'll find us.
That's awesome. Well, what's next for you after all this? You got a new project in mind, or are you just taking some time?
There's a project that I think I'm going to direct. It looks like I'm going to direct it. So I don't want to talk about it too much until the contract's done, but I'm hoping that it'll go through, and that's awesome. Keep me busy for a couple of years, which is great. And
yeah.
Then we'll see. You know, I think it's going to be a while. My past three projects have all been films that I have conceived of and originated and pushed up the mountain and raised the money for. And it's a lot of work. And I'm ready to work with other people.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, your executive producers on this film.
I've been super lucky to have the support of Brad Pitt and Henry Louis Gates Jr. on this film. Their names mean a lot. And I'm very appreciative of them lending support.
It's very important in getting accurate African-American history, you know, out there. So that's amazing. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you for having me. I really sincerely appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Rachel. I highly encourage you to please go check out Civil War or Who Do We Think We Are. The documentary is available for free to watch on Peacock, as well as tonight at 10 p.m. on MSNBC. It truly is a wonderful piece, and I really enjoyed the differing perspectives and getting a glimpse into how different people think about one specific moment in history.
Be sure to head over to www.greengables.org for more information about the house on Foggy Bluff. The Haunted Ghost Walk is going on until Halloween night, October 31st. Head on over to beunique.org. Like, follow, support my beautiful humans over there for all things me. You can find me as PupDuffy on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter. You can follow the show on Facebook. It's Coffee, Candy, and Creatives. As always, take care of each other, love each other, and watch each other's backs.